think I heard she did a great show up in Chicagoland, Annie DeFranco, recently. I've never seen her live, though she has played here. My name's Paul Muth. I'm not doing music, as you might know. I'm suffering from the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and I woke up with a headache, and I haven't shaken it yet. So, Nomu Mia Abu Jamal. I commend your attention to the nearly hour-long interview that Amy Goodman did with the other political prisoner of note who's had his sentence commuted, and he's restricted to a certain part of Dakota Territory. I think it's not quite the size of a county, but apparently while Amy Goodman was out that way at the Sundance, she made it down to North Dakota and interviewed Leonard Peltier on his in his territory, which I'm quite happy that he made it back there. I wish Mamiya would get out and get some real health care. The health care system is not serving a lot of what is going on. It seems like I might be having a computer glitch here, which case maybe I will play Amy, prison radio commentary for Mumia, since I think I might need a plan B. Nope. The computer I've been operating on is sluggish alongside of me. We're both sluggish this morning. Hope you're sitting comfortably. There's so much to sort out, and we'll only get to what I can from these clips that I've assembled for you. We're quite happy to hear a live interview here on this morning. Special edition of Catch the Beat on Market Street. I do hope there's a place for the Counterspin show. There was quite a good segment about an half-hour length interview about the three boats now counting. Maybe there's four that have been demolished, destroyed, people killed in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of Venezuela. It's a bit hard to understand. So with that as a four-piece, I will get it together. I've got Joel Beinon, Craig Aaron from Free Press, the organization that was started by Bob McChesney, who used to be in the media studies program here at U of I, the late Bob McChesney, media center in downtown Urbana, Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, is thinking about a memorial for him at some point around the 25th anniversary, which is in October at the IMC. I was just talking to Cope about the memorial for late, great Belden Fields. He will be remembered at an event at the IMC. We're just still in the stages of planning it. I Zoomed with him regularly and working on the public eye. I guess that gives me a place to mention my article about the modular nuclear plant that the U of I assigned a contract to build alongside the railroad tracks in right in the center of town. I have an article opposing that, and I used the resource of a book called Nuclear Power. Nuclear is Not the Answer by a scholar out in the University of British Columbia. I have a segment from him that I'll play part of. This is from a program by Libby Halevy called Nuclear Hot Seat. She's been doing it for decades. And it's great material, sobering stuff. Have a web exclusive from Amy Goodman, which I guess I'll get to right after her Breaking the Sound Barrier essay, which is commemorating Robert Redford, activist or actor. She made it to Sundance regularly, and a documentary about her and Democracy Now! Was screened, I believe, at Sundance, if not another film festival out west. I believe the name of the documentary is called steal this story, please, which sort of is a nod to her doing the stories that are not reported in your local media. So if you appreciate alternative media, I assume you do because you're listening, if you can see clear to make a donation or encourage other people to do the same, come down and celebrate at the WEF Fest, which, make a note, check your calendar, and I'm seeing a poster here that for some reason doesn't include the date, but it's upcoming. So, September 28th, a couple of Sundays hence, I'll be preempted for the other show I do called Window on the World. Speaking of other shows, other endeavors I do, I did make it to the Friday Forum, which had two great speakers from the new American Welcome Center, which is now hosted, or they have their office in Lincoln Square. Used to be at the University YMCA, but now they're focusing on the community more so, I guess. All right, that's all much too long of an introduction to the material I'm going to play. I guess I'll take it off of the last segment I'm going to play, Nuclear Hot Seat. So Joel Beinan, Craig Aaron from Free Press about the media machinations, Judith Butler about her experience at UCal Berkeley, which has turned over files on about 100 people, students and faculty both, who are suspiciously speaking out about Israel, Palestine, and Gaza genocide. So they have, their dossier has been turned over to the Trump regime, shall we call it that by now. Here's Amy Goodman remembering our activist, actor Robert Redford, though he did quite a bit more than that, producing and all sorts of things too.
Robert Redford, the actor and the activist. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast.
Just follow the money.
That's one of the most legendary lines ever from a Hollywood movie spoken by Hal Holbrook in the role of Deep Throat, a Nixon administration whistleblower in All the President's Men. Deep Throat secretly met with reporter Bob Woodward of The Washington Post, advising Woodward as he investigated the Watergate scandal with Post colleague Carl Bernstein. Woodward and Bernstein exposed a web of corruption in the White House that ultimately forced President Richard Nixon to resign. Woodward was played by Robert Redford, the legendary actor, director, and activist who died this week at his home in Utah at the age of 89. Democracy Now! Frequently interviewed Robert Redford over the years. In 2012, he reflected on that role.
To me, stories that were worth telling were stories about what's the truth beneath the truth that you're given or you think you know. And I think that, like All the President's Men, was, well, what's the truth? What's the story about two guys that did something other people weren't doing that managed to take down a top figure in government? How did that work?
Renowned for roles in films like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The Sting, and The Way We Were, Redford won an Oscar for directing Ordinary People and numerous other awards over his storied career. But what mattered most to him was independent film. Pursuing truth and confronting power was central to Redford's long career. The power of Hollywood studios inspired him to found the Sundance Film Festival, as he explained on Democracy Now! In 2015.
What if we can start a development process where young artists can have a voice, but we can help them develop their skills so they can at least get their films made? That was the lab that started in 1980. Then, once that happened and we started a development process at Sundance, suddenly realized that we were helping them develop their skills so they could get their films made, but there was nowhere to go because the mainstream had not allowed any space for them. And that led to the idea of a festival. So originally, it was just an idea that maybe we can have a community of filmmakers coming together and share each other's work. And maybe if we're lucky, somebody will come.
And come they did. The Sundance Film Festival is the largest independent film festival in the U.S., drawing upwards of 120,000 attendees for 10 days in late January to the tiny mountain town of Park City, Utah. The festival may be a victim of its own success. This January's festival will be the final one in Park City, after which it will relocate to the larger city of Boulder, Colorado. In 2010, Redford explained on Democracy Now! That despite the festival's growth, he and his staff were committed to its original mission.
So what came to my mind was a T.S. Eliot poem that I've always been fond of, that begins with, "Let us not cease from exploration." And then it goes in a circular line to the end where it ends with, "So that we may return to the place we started and see it as if for the first time." And that sort of was the idea. Let's go back to our roots. And now, 25 years later, for a lot of people, it might seem fresh and new. But mainly for us is to remind us of who we were, when, and what we did, taking new chances and carving new areas. And so that's what this festival is all about.
Redford was also a committed environmental activist. He told us in 2015.
I worked in an oil field. As a kid, I worked in the Chevron oil fields in California. So I've had a lot of experience with oil. I think it should stay in the ground now. And I think that we're so close to polluting the planet beyond anything sustainable.
And in 2016, not long after returning from the major UN climate summit in Paris, where he worked on organizing elected mayors and indigenous populations for climate action, he added,
"And I've been more radicalized over time as I've seen the consequence of how the environment has been treated. So climate change is a big part of that."
Robert Redford and his son James co-founded the Redford Center, a nonprofit dedicated to environmental impact filmmaking. James' untimely death from cancer in 2020 at 58 deeply impacted his father. In their online statement after Robert's death this week, the Redford Center wrote, quote, "His work has elevated voices that might otherwise have gone unheard and moved generations of filmmakers, organizers, and citizens to take bold action for the environment. Bob showed us that hope is a discipline and that creativity can be a force for justice," unquote. Redford's friend, co-star, and longtime climate activist Jane Fonda wrote online after learning of his death, quote, "Bob made a real difference in all good ways. He represented an America we must now fight to protect. I'm very sad today. Cried all morning," Jane Fonda said. Independent media was Redford's calling. As the crackdown on dissent intensifies in the United States, no doubt Robert Redford would repeat the call of the early 20th century labor activist Joe Hill. Don't mourn, organize. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay. I didn't preview that, so I didn't know we had the Watergate Association there. If I'd have been thinking ahead to this pledge drive, maybe I'd have contacted Democracy Now! And asked about getting some of this new documentary film as a premium. But please don't necessarily expect a premium. There are some. I'll run that down a little bit later, hopefully. The documentary Steal This Story, Please, about Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman was premiered at the Telluride Film Fest and opened the D.C. Docs Festival. I guess that's Washington, D.C. And, yeah. So she had a web exclusive with a follow-up interview with Judith Butler. That was, I heard the live one, but not yet the one we're about to hear. And yeah, let's get rid of some of this. Noise in the system here. Amy Goodman's web exclusive with Judith Butler. We're going to go to that right now. Again, you can call while the phone is while I'm playing material, and I've got a lot to play today, and my headache is abating. I guess I've got enough caffeine in my system now for that to be opening up the capillaries or whatever it's doing, more about free speech and its suppression. This on college campuses, this one. We'll have more with the discussion with the Free Press director, something. Again, that's the organization that Bob McChesney began.
Films made. That was the lab that started in 1980.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue with part two in our conversation with Judith Butler, philosopher, political commentator, and gender studies scholar. They're a distinguished professor in the Graduate School at the University of California, Berkeley, and the Hannah Arendt Chair at the European Graduate School. On Friday, the University of California, Berkeley said it had provided Trump officials with the names of at least 160 students, faculty, and staff complying with a federal investigation into alleged anti-Semitism on college campuses. Professor Butler is also on the Academic Council of Jewish Voice for Peace. Their new article in the Chronicle of Higher Education is headlined, "When Universities Become Informants, a Practice from the McCarthy Era Makes an Ugly Return." Judith Butler, it's great to have you with us in our New York studio. In part one of our conversation, we got your reaction to your name being handed over to the Department of Education. I think it's Office of Civil Rights.
For Civil Rights.
And this was 160 students and staff and professors you included. You got this on Friday. In fact, that was in the letter they told you several weeks after they actually handed over your names. Can you talk about the significance of that period of time and what it means that your university has handed over this number of names? The UC Office of the President said its campuses, quote, routinely receive document requests in connection with government audits, compliance reviews, or investigations, and that UC and all public universities are subject to federal and state oversight. But a spokesperson told the San Francisco Chronicle, quote, UC is committed to protecting the privacy of our students, faculty, and staff to the greatest extent possible while fulfilling its legal obligations. Your response?
Well, it may have legal obligations. Of course, it does have legal obligations to comply with the Department of Education when it seeks to know whether it is complying with Title VI. And in this case, they wanted to know whether the UC campuses in general, all the campuses, were complying with Title VI, and in particular,
Title VI being
the policy against discrimination that is adopted, that the government has formulated and which is imposed on all those who receive federal funds from the government. So, but Title VI was meant to protect against discrimination, racial discrimination, discrimination on the basis of nationality and religion. It was important civil rights achievement, but it also, let me just add, Title VI provides for those accused of infractions, you know, those accused of racism or anti-Semitism or discrimination of some kind, to be apprised of the allegation, to be able to defend themselves, and to be able to go through a bona fide review where their own point of view and counter evidence can be presented. None of that happened here. So even though the government thinks it's monitoring Title VI, the way in which it's doing it is in fact destroying some of the provisions guaranteed by Title VI. All of us accused have a right to know what the accusation is, to be able to rebut, to give our own point of view, to produce counter evidence and the like, and to go through a procedure where we're apprised of what's going on. So the fact is that all of the University of California campuses gave names. UC Berkeley is the only campus that informed those whose names were sent forward that our names were sent forward. So we were apprised of that. We were not apprised what the allegation is, and we were given no opportunity to refute them or provide counter evidence, of course. But we do not know the number of people in the University of California communities, all of the campuses, whose names are in files where there's an allegation of anti-Semitism. It could be 1,000. It could be more than 1,000. It's 160 at UC Berkeley. What is it at UCLA? I don't know.
So, Judith Butler, yours is one of the names. In part one of our discussion, you particularly talked about your concern not for yourself,
right,
but especially international students whose names may have been turned over because they could lose their visas or worse, detained, etc. You are, in addition to being a philosopher, gender studies scholar, distinguished professor at the Graduate School at University of California, Berkeley, you are the Hannah Arendt Chair at the European Graduate School. Explain who Hannah Arendt is and how you think she would have responded. Refugee from the Holocaust who actually was at Berkeley, who was a professor there.
Well, she was briefly there. That's true. She got into good fights with people there. Hannah Arendt wrote a really important article called Moral Responsibility Under Dictatorship. And she points out that all of the officials who are asked to implement, in that case, dictatorial policies, but we could say fascist policies or authoritarian policies, all the officials who are asked to implement are reproducing and intensifying fascism, intensifying authoritarianism. So when I asked the legal counsel at UC Berkeley, why did you comply? He said to me quite clearly, this is my job. And I thought to myself, you have not read Hannah Arendt. I said, did it ever occur to you not to comply? No. Did you know that other people have not complied? He said, no, I'm not aware of that. So in fact, we get compliance from the University of California President's Office with an absolutely treacherous demand on the part of the Department of Education. And then everyone down the line, all the legal counsels who know better, who actually know better that this is a deep abrogation of basic rights, comply, produce the lists, and send off those files. Now, I will say that maybe that they made some decisions in how best to comply. And I note that many activists on the Berkeley campus and elsewhere are not included in those files. So I don't know how they made those decisions, but they should have said no. And Hannah Arendt blamed Eichmann, for instance, in her book on the Eichmann trial, for being a cog in the wheel and for not exercising what she calls judgment. Like, do I comply? Do I not comply? Am I being asked to break the law? Am I being asked to abide by or conform to a law that is unjust? And if I see it as unjust, I must oppose it as unjust and be disobedient and take the consequences. But what lawyer who in the legal counsels, the legal counsel offices of all the University of California campuses, who stood up and said, this is unjust, I am willing to lose my job, I will not implement this? No one. As far as I know, no one.
It's been interesting seeing Columbia University's acquiescence to the administration and Harvard University's opposing the administration and a federal judge, Allison Burroughs, just ruling that the Trump administration can't cut off billions of dollars in research funding to Harvard, saying that Harvard was using anti-Semitism as a smokescreen. You're a Jewish professor. You're an advisor to Jewish Voice for Peace. A significant percentage of the protesters across the country this past year around Israel's assault on Gaza have been Jewish, and yet you are being targeted.
Well, I understand that it's my political speech that's being targeted. I've never uttered anything that's anti-Semitic. But if you accept the IHRA definition, the International Holocaust Remembrance Association, their definition of anti-Semitism, then any time you make a strong criticism of the state of Israel, you are eligible for the allegation of anti-Semitism. So their definition of anti-Semitism is way overbroad, right? It includes all kinds of political speech that should be protected under the First Amendment. And I'm openly critical of the state of Israel. I've been calling this a genocide from early on. I did so on your show a year and a half ago. But I think that, in fact, we have two different issues here. One, a system like the University of California is dependent on federal funding, and it doesn't want to lose that funding, and it sees the threat made against everyone else, and it itself has received a threat. If it's not compliant with this investigation, it will very possibly be deprived of federal funding. At the same time, it has to accept the equation of political speech against genocide as anti-Semitic. It has to accept that and patrol for it and enforce it. So we have both the fear of losing money on the one hand and a complicity with the U.S. support for the genocidal conditions and ongoing practices in Gaza.
Your campus, for our global audience, is very significant. The University of California, Berkeley, as the Guardian notes, and that you talked about, that UC Berkeley is home to the free speech movement in the 60s. You've said, we've been a place where controversial public issues can be freely debated. We have different views on Israel-Palestine. We need to hear them even when they upset us. That's the spirit of the place that I've been championing and affirming for 30 years. So it's a heartbreak and it's disgraceful.
Yes, it is. And it's the students who've been out there making clear their opposition to the University of California's investment in companies that serve the occupation and the genocide against Palestinians. And it is their rights of free speech that are being demonized and criminalized at this moment. Those students are the brave ones who are actually carrying the tradition of Berkeley free speech forward into the future. We should be applauding them. We should not be criminalizing them.
As a gender studies professor, you are author of the book, Who's Afraid of Gender? Can you talk about how the trans community has become a political target of the right? You write, why is freedom so frightening? Is that even the question? Or is rather, how has freedom been made to seem so frightening that people find themselves longing for authoritarian rule? What do you mean by this, Professor Butler?
Well, I do think that the rise of authoritarian powers in different parts of the world, and we can think about the Bolsonaro regime, I gather he's going to jail. I think that's a good idea. I'm an abolitionist, but I think that's a good idea. Orban, especially in Hungary. Millet, who's rolling back progressive gender legislation in Argentina. But also Trump. These authoritarian figures, Erdogan, clearly, in Turkey, they have all been anti-gender. They want to restore the family to its classical model. They want marriage to be restricted to two heterosexuals. they want rights for trans people to gain access to healthcare and have their legal status changed to be rolled back. And their patriarchal aims, their patriarchal fantasies about the future and about their own place in it, demand that we return to a notion of biological sex as determining who we are. And they have certain ideas of what biological sex might be, which are very controversial, but at least the sex assigned at birth. And they're also obviously trying to keep the family in place as heteronormative as part of the building of nationalism. So, for instance, you know, Orban is also against miscegenation. He's afraid that women will start reproducing with refugees, and he doesn't want to see his country darkened in that way. But look, the main point I would say here is that the rights stripping activity that's happening against trans people, being deprived of legal status, of health care, of safety, of discrimination, anti-discrimination protections, that rights stripping is happening across the board, right? We need to think about that rights stripping in terms of what's happening with students when they're being deported. Their rights are also being stripped. What's happening to people who are losing their jobs because they made use of constitutionally protected political expression. There are constitutional rights, there are international rights that are being destroyed across the board, which is one reason why the movement for trans rights should be linked with all of our other political movements, because we're seeing rights stripping across the board, which is, of course, a major tactic of authoritarian powers.
And you have the horror of the assassination of Charlie Kirk last week, who was at the Utah campus. And at the moment that he was shot dead, he was being questioned by, it turns out, a young man very similar to him. He had a wife and two kids, but he was very opposed to Charlie Kirk. And he got to the front and he had a chance to question him. And he was asking about trans mass shooters and how they compare to the number of mass shooters overall. At which point Charlie Kirk was shot. How this has become such a central issue of the right's attack on progressivism in the United States. Your final thoughts?
Yes. Well, I think the right, the Christian right especially, has produced two kinds of specters. One is trans, the other one is the migrant. And they both hit at very intimate issues of family, of sexuality, of association. They bring racism together with transphobia. Anti-feminism as well. And, you know, there was that that meme that was circulated by Elon Musk, apparently. If Kamala Harris were elected, she would perform trans surgeries on migrants. And, of course, it was completely fictitious, but it was a very exciting lie for a lot of people. It's like, yes, that's not the world we want, trans surgeries. You know, people are afraid their kids will come home from college with trans surgeries or, you know, that they'll be somehow subject to an ideology. But trans emancipation, trans struggles are about freedom, are about being able to live and breathe in the world without fear of violence. The rights that we owe for new migrants in this country, they also should be able to live and breathe without fear of violence and discrimination. They should all be given the health care they need. They should all be given the rights to shelter that they need. That the most vulnerable communities are demonized. We know this from the history of fascism. It's happening again. And that they get melded together in crazy fantasies about both communities excite hatred, and then that gets exploited by our right-wing fascists to their own ends. So we need to fight that not just with strong arguments, but with really compelling visions.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Judith Butler, philosopher, political commentator, gender studies scholar, distinguished professor in the Graduate School at University of California, Berkeley, and the Hannah Arendt Chair at the European Graduate School. They're on the Academic Council of Jewish Voice for Peace. Professor Butler is the author of numerous books, most recently, Who's Afraid of Gender? We'll link to their new piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education, headlined When Universities Become Informants, a practice from the McCarthy era makes an ugly return. To see part one of our discussion, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. And thanks so much for joining us.
Well, she had it all right in front of her. I was going to reprise the name of that Chronicle of Higher Education article, When Universities Become Informants, Ugly Return from the McCarthy Era. Okay, that was a web exclusive. As usual, I think I can put on a lot more than I can, and I can't speed it up as much as I could if I was listening at home. But I will get to the Joel Beinan piece tomorrow with Brian Edwards Tiekert. But while we're talking about media and the distortion that's going on, I thought we should hear from Craig Aaron and then prerogative, I'll put on the interview with V.I. Ramada. I should have had that in front of me. The interview with Libby Halevy from Nuclear Hot Seat. This is the third one she's done. It was important for me. I did read the book after I wrote the article that I was basing on sections I found in it, I guess I'll say. Yeah, in the latest Public Eye, which is soon to be superseded by another issue coming up out this week. Look for it. There's still issues around town. My article about the nanonuclear U of I contract to build a modular, cute little under 300 kilowatt nuclear reactor in the middle of town by the railroad tracks. Hadn't even thought of a train wreck as a possible threat to the reactor until I read the late Bruce Hannon's article that was in Smile Politely. People still don't know this is going ahead. I haven't investigated the nuclear aspects of the deal with the special relationship UK, Starmer and Trump. Pretty amazing stuff, a lot of stuff to unpack on that trip. I think he might have brought a gold carriage home, though I've heard he doesn't like horses. I'm talking about Trump now, not Starmer. But the gold leaf that's been commented on, the thing that sticks out to me that hasn't been commented on is the gold replica of the pager that was used in the attack in Lebanon by Mossad. Netanyahu brought a little souvenir for Trump. Wasn't commented on much at the time because it's the same visit by Netanyahu that Trump talked about Riviera on the Gaza and how we were going to take it over for a while till things worked out. So the hideousness of this pager memorabilia was not commented on. It shows that Mossad shares the same disregard for civilians that the Israeli military do. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. I didn't expect to extemporize that much on that. But here's Brian Edwards Tiekert with Craig Aaron. He's well introduced here. There's a nice little synopsis of the situation from Brian Tiekert's point of view. And then we'll get to the nuclear hot seat and nuclear power, something very local in the sense that, there's going to be one in our town if things go ahead as planned.
My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert. Now to turn to the dismal state of press freedom in the United States. Here is a quick recap of the latest maneuver to completely consume those of us who care about having a free press. Monday night, ABC Late Night host Jimmy Kimmel goes on the air, and in his opening monologue says the following, quote, "We hit some new lows over the weekend with the MAGA gang desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and doing everything they can to score political points from it." Basically, factual statement. There was still an open debate over the exact politics of the person who shot Charlie Kirk, but Kimmel was not making any claims contrary to fact. Nevertheless, there was a complete explosion directed at him among right-wing influencers, including Trump administration's chair of the Federal Communications Commission, Brendan Carr, who went on a right-wing podcast on Wednesday and said, in reference to Kimmel, "We can do this the easy way, or we can do this the hard way." Brendan Carr's words, quote, "These companies can find ways to change conduct and take actions on Kimmel, or there's going to be additional work for the FCC ahead." The FCC has the power to revoke broadcast licenses for the broadcasters that carry programming from ABC, including Jimmy Kimmel Show. Well, ABC decided that the FCC could do that the easy way. They told Jimmy Kimmel just minutes before he was supposed to go on the air that night that he was suspended indefinitely. And that is where things stand now. We've invited on Craig Aaron, who is president of Free Press. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back, Brian.
So maybe you could kind of start with the basic political economy here, because it's not obvious on the face of it why a large company with, one assumes, a decent budget to pay for lawyers would be complying in advance with diktats from the Trump administration when it comes to coverage.
Yeah, that's, in some ways, that's the question. And this level of corporate capitulation, how easy they made it, really is truly shocking. And we shouldn't lose sight of that. The explanation is a fairly simple one, which is these executives have calculated while doing great damage to free speech and democracy in this country, but they've calculated that it is better for them to trash their own employees, their own newsrooms, abandon any claims to free speech and free expression in order to push through mega deals during the Trump administration. So the conglomerates, the chains of local affiliates who have business before the FCC jumped as quickly as they could. Brendan Carr goes on the podcast. Here comes Nexstar, the largest owner of television stations in the country. Here comes Sinclair. I believe they're the number two in terms of reach as a national chain, already a propaganda arm of the Trump administration. And they immediately announced, we're not going to air Jimmy Kimmel anymore. Sinclair adds, we're not going to air Jimmy Kimmel anymore until he makes a personal, meaningful personal donation to Charlie Kirk's political operation. This is who controls our nation's television stations. And then ABC follows suit. And of course, ABC has its own deals in front of the FCC. They're going to need approval for various mergers to manage their coverage of the NFL and all these other things. And so when you look at the reporting that's coming out of these companies, you know, you're hearing, or out of ABC anyway, you're hearing some people saying, wait, Jimmy Kimmel didn't say anything, because Jimmy Kimmel didn't say anything. And then the executives and the bosses, starting at the very top with Bob Iger, saying it's just not worth it. We have to, you know, bend the knee to the Trump administration and, you know, give up here. Somehow here, 6 months in, you know, 9 months in, sorry, to this administration, it's time flies. These companies are still not learning the most basic lesson of the Trump administration, which is when you roll over, when you give up, they just keep coming for more and more. So we have a company like Disney ABC that a little more than a year ago decided to try to pay off the Trump administration, settle a specious lawsuit against George Stephanopoulos for allegedly defaming Donald Trump, a very, very public figure, but they decided they'd rather pay $15 million to the Trump library or whatever, rather than stand up for press freedom. Here comes Trump again. Here comes his hatchet man, Brendan Carr, again. And once again, we see corporate media failing and capitulating in ways that do great harm to journalism, to free speech, and really to all of us. Though I take some solace in the fact that this one is so blatant, so unforgivable, that it really does seem to be breaking through the public consciousness. So didn't have defending Jimmy Kimmel on my list of things I thought I'd be doing in 2025. But here we are, and we need to be defending Jimmy Kimmel.
I think the kind of mechanics of the broadcast industry are a little opaque to most of us.
Sure.
But ABC pays to make the content. License holders like Nexstar and Sinclair pay to license it and put it on their broadcastees. It's the licensees, it's the Nexstar, the Sinclair, who the FCC has the most direct control over. Like in 2025, do we know how financially important those contracts are to a company like ABC? How much of its audience is tuning in over the air these days?
Well, I think when you add in, you know, people, you know, obviously over the air, but also cable television, still a significant audience, especially, you know, with what's left of advertising, you know, the parts of that that really support these broadcast networks. I'm not going to pretend that broadcast isn't an industry on the decline for all the obvious reasons of streaming and everything else. But these local stations, especially when it comes to live sports and local news coverage, are incredibly, still incredibly important and still incredibly lucrative. The system that the FCC is exploiting here, of course, was intended originally to put these public airwaves and these local stations in local hands. But over the last, you know, several decades, we've seen this incredible consolidation. So we're no longer talking, you know, about a local independent family-owned operation, somebody you might bump into at the grocery store, or I guess in the case of broadcast owners, maybe the country club. You're talking about these huge changing conglomerates controlling hundreds and hundreds of stations and making tons and tons of money, especially off of election ads and things like that during that season. So these are still very, very influential media outlets. That is not lost on the Trump administration, who is doing everything it can to put more and more of those local outlets in the hands of these ideologically aligned or ideologically squishy companies that are so willing to do their bidding. So we're not talking about small guys anymore. This in some ways is really showing just how much sway and power these big chains have, because, you know, they account for such a big part of ABC's reach. Nexstar has several dozen ABC affiliates. Sinclair, I think, has more than 30 ABC affiliates in major markets. They're the biggest number of ABC affiliates. So they both have all these policy favors they want. They want to get even bigger, but ABC at some level does have to pay attention to this. And of course, they have their own business deals, their own ambitions. You know, ABC is a Disney property. They have other things they're going to want from the Trump administration. And again, the short-term boardroom demands and executive demands are trumping all other concerns. But these are big concerns. These are democracy. These are free expression. This is really,
whether we're going to continue to have those things. What business does Disney have in front of Trump-appointed regulators?
Sure. I don't know all the mergers Disney would like to pull off. And I imagine somewhere in the files at ABC, they're looking at, you know, other deals, because all these companies are anticipating that this Trump administration, if you play ball, is going to allow them to sweep up even more more properties. But specifically, they have some arrangements that they're trying to take over something called Fubo. It's like a streaming service that they want to get their hands on. There's necessary federal approvals that involve some of the moving around of their NFL coverage, which is the most lucrative thing for these local companies. Those are the short-term ones. And I think, you know, there are a bunch of business deals, and there's been a lot of reporting this week. Oliver Darcy's Status newsletter has a lot of details about the things right in front of ABC that they don't want to give up. But these are also companies betting that a lot of things are going to come on the market. And if you're Disney or Fox or one of these big conglomerates, you're recognizing that in a time of just, you know, unfettered runaway consolidation, what happens is the number of companies that can buy anything gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So you allow more consolidation, then there's only a few players. Maybe that's somebody trying to buy ABC or various properties, or in this case, because Disney's so big, it's probably them looking to sweep up some other property that becomes available, whether that's an internet property, whether that's all the cable channels, you know, ESPN and all the other things that Disney controls, or other outlets. And in that grand scheme, in that scheme of multi-billion dollar deals, suddenly somebody even as big a star as Jimmy Kimmel doesn't really rank. And that's why I think you see these companies beginning to bend the knee. And look, some of this is also ideological alignment. A lot of people, the billionaires who run media companies, they have their business interests at heart, but a lot of them are also ideologically aligned with Trump's MAGA project. And you can see that from the tech guys lining up behind him on stage to all the other executives that are showing up in the paved over Rose Garden, again, to, you know, bend the knee, kiss the ring, and hope they're going to get to cash in and give them even more influence, more power, maybe even to pick the next guy when Trump is gone. That's the kind of bets these companies are making. It's just obviously disastrous for the rest of us.
No kings, indeed. That's Craig Aaron of Free Press, freepress.net, if I recall. And Brian Edwards Tiekert had him on, I believe, Thursday morning. The show up front is available as a freestanding podcast, so you can hear the very end of that as well. So instead of me saying again, let's start with Libby Olivi out of the West Coast, LA area, longtime producer of a podcast called Nuclear Hot Seat. Here an interview with a Canadian scholar, maybe he's an activist too. I'd like to bring him to campus, actually, since he has a lot to say about nuclear power. Since his book is called Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, Folly of Nuclear in the Era of Climate Change, something of that effect. Maybe we'll hear it from Ms. Olivi. Radio Free Labor is at a big conference. Both Stephanie and Gus are at a conference that they were talking about at least last week, maybe the week before, anticipated the absence, we're going to replay an edition of that show at the top of the hour, just so you know. And, yeah, so they want Fubo. Disney covets Fubo. All right, sorry, I'm in the weeds on that one, too.
The solution, the folly of atomic power in the age of climate change, that has just been published by M.V. Ramana. Ramana is professor and Simmons Chair of Disarmament, Global and Human Security at the University of British Columbia, International Nuclear Risk Assessment Group, and he may be familiar to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners as a member of the team that produces the annual World Nuclear Industry Status Report. I spoke with Ramana on September 27, 2024. M.V. Ramana, it is so great and such an honor to have you with us this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
The honor is mine to be, and so full of admiration for all the work you've been doing over the many, many years. Thank you so much.
And thank you. I'd like to start out with a quote from the introduction in your book, Nuclear is Not the Solution. This is where you state that your book's, quote, deeper purpose is to demonstrate through the example of nuclear energy why it is important to understand that the climate catastrophe to be as much a crisis of political economy as it is a crisis of ecology resulting from technological choices. There's a lot to unpack in that. Can you give us an overview as to what you mean?
In a way, though, the book started with my asking what seems like a puzzle to many of us, which is we know that nuclear energy is expensive, it takes a lot of time, it's risky, we don't know how to deal with radioactive waste producers, and it's linked with nuclear weapons. We know all of those for decades now. Why is it that governments and corporations are still investing in this technology? Why are they promoting it? That was a fundamental question that I started with. And you know, as you might see in the book, four of the chapters have to deal with that. The first two chapters are sort of a cataloging of things that at least people who are listening to your program know only too well. And to me, all of that, whatever I learned in those trying to understand that question, is speaking to the larger society. It's not specific to nuclear energy. It is to how our society is structured in such an unequal fashion with gross inequalities of wealth and power, and how the people who are wealthy use the wealth to get power to get things done the way they want, while at the same time passing on the cost and the risk to the vast majority of the public. And so this is something which we are going to be seeing even if we are thinking about other technologies, be it oil and gas and coal, or even renewables, right? Many of the bad environmental impacts of it and the health impacts of it are outsourced to disempowered communities around the world. Think of where the solar panels might be getting dumped. Think of where the materials for which come from and what are the kind of horrendous conditions under which people mine those things. And they are all indicative of the political economy of our society rather than the technology per se.
Well, that takes care of my first five questions. okay, let me just edit this down to one of the quotes you use that struck me is from Noam Chomsky. And he said, what you have is a system of socialization cost and risk and privatization of profit. How have a handful of large and financially powerful organizations profited from building and operating nuclear power plants at the public's expense?
You know, let's take the example of the latest power plant that has started operating in the United States, the Vogtle plant. In the book, I document, and I have to rely completely on activists on the ground in Georgia who are documenting all of this work, and I mention all of them, the groups in the book. They have shown how Georgia Power's profits jumped immediately after the legislative act that allowed Georgia Power to pass on costs to customers. I'll back up and explain a little bit about how the electricity sector in the United States is structured.
Please do.
Historically, the way that the electricity sector has been structured was to allow companies that were supplying electricity to charge customers whatever they are spending, plus a profit margin. So every year, the company would say, here are all our expenses. These are our capital expenses. These are our operating expenses. And we spent, let's say, $100 million. And we want permission to charge the customers X cents per kilowatt hour so that the amount that you're charging is adequate to pay back all of the expenses that we have, plus a profit margin. This has been a well-known problem in the electricity sector, in that if a company finds a way to pass on some costs, it's to their benefit. Right? They can gold plate their projects and pass on the costs, as long as they're allowed to pass on the costs. And the people who allow them to pass on the costs are some regulatory body, sort of a public utilities commission. So the public utilities commission, historically, have also been compromised in various ways. There is regulatory capture. People who go in and out of these bodies try to then promote the interests of the companies rather than the public, even though they're supposed to be public utilities commission. You know this, as and most of your readers, listeners probably know about this, in the case of Georgia, where the utilities commission has been completely taken over. Now, what changed in Georgia and also in South Carolina where the only other recent projects sort of started, was that the companies were allowed by legislation to charge customers even before the nuclear reactor was constructed. So as the construction process started, the bills of these customers went up without any guarantee that they were actually going to get some rewards for that extra cost. And the place where that whole arrangement meant that even though the project was canceled after over $9 billion was spent, customers are still getting charged for it, for electricity they never saw, essentially for a big hole in the ground there. In Georgia, on the other hand, the reactor was completed at an enormous cost increase, and yet the customers were paying not what they originally were told it was going to be costing, but actually for all the extra costs that were spent. But the profits for this went to the owners of the stocks, the financial companies that were owning money or were investing in this project, and to all of the executives in the company. So in South Carolina, again, for the failed project, many of these executives got what were called golden parachutes, where even if the project was to be abandoned, they would get millions of dollars as bonuses. So there are lots of ways in which this arrangement incentivizes companies to A, invest in very expensive projects, in this case, nuclear power plants, and continue with the project, even though it is very apparent that the project was not going to be on time, on budget, or deliver electricity. And this is actually, you can even go further back. The incentive to promote a nuclear project when it was already clear that renewables were much cheaper was also present. It was because of these incentives that utilities were not trying to find out what is the cheapest way to supply electricity, what is the most efficient and the quickest way to supply electricity, and what is the cleanest way. None of that they're interested in, because there's economic incentives all way in light or in line with them making huge amounts of money if for expensive projects.
You do an extensive and scathing analysis of South Carolina's scandal over the never built or never completed VC summer nuclear reactors. And as you mentioned earlier, you highlight that the warnings were given against the project by activist groups, environmental groups such as Friends of the Earth, and that all of these warnings were ignored, even though they eventually proved not only accurate, but prescient. They predicted what was going to happen with tremendous accuracy. Could you explain how in the world the voice of reason gets drowned out in these hearings, and the bad path is almost invariably chosen?
There are very powerful interests who benefit from going down this wrong. I already talked about the case of utility companies. In the case of the legislature and so on, though it's not necessarily clear in South Carolina, in other states, we have seen major corruption scandals. In the case of Ohio, the most egregious of that, in the case of First Energy. There are interests for legislators also to actually pass on these costs to customers. And the customers and their representatives, the civil society organizations and the environmental organizations, including Friends of the Earth in the case of South Carolina, and activists like Tom Clements, have very little capacity to influence these people in comparison with all of these very moneyed interests. They don't have the lobbying capacity. They don't have the capacity to go and wine and dine all these people, right? All you can do is to show up at hearings and try to put in your testimony, go have demonstrations, write letters, write op-eds. But they can all be ignored by legislators because they are not fundamentally accountable. And this is, I think, again, one of those questions about larger political economy, larger society.
One of the things that I have found most frustrating, and it happens across the board, is that the media lead with the nuclear industry's perspective and talking points. And of course, that's reinforced by World Nuclear News from the World Nuclear Association. And it's like accepted truth is not true when it comes to the media's reporting. Do you have any insights on how those of us who oppose nuclear and have the truth, such as when Friends of the Earth were speaking it, or any of the activist groups speaking to public utilities commissions, or here in California, the Coastal Commission, or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, do you have any insights on how we might be better and more powerful in putting our points across?
Yeah, maybe this question needs to be rephrased, because I don't have an answer for that, right? I mean, we're all struggling with it, and we are getting our asses kicked on so many different fronts. So yes, we need to do something different. I don't think I know really the answer. Set of things that I do, you know, I write op-eds, I write books, I go and talk to people, to, you know, groups, to civil society organizations, things of that sort. But in the larger scheme of things, we are not able to shift the needle. The forces that are against us are so powerful. The only thing we have on our side are facts and a lot of committed people who seem to be very sincere in their work and who are willing to do this tirelessly and without reward. That's what we have on our side. But in terms of trying to match up with the money and the political power of the nuclear industry, it's a very difficult thing.
I'm certainly working on some media angles, especially for next year, 2025, which is the 80th anniversary of the start of all this nuclear mess. Mm-hmm. Because what we're up against is that the media always leads in nuclear stories with the nuclear industry talking points. And maybe down at the bottom, if it's print, there's a paragraph that quotes somebody who's an activist saying, no, this really isn't a good idea. But we don't get that primacy in the articles. Why do you see it that the media is doing this?
I think there are two angles. The first is most journalists are working on extremely tight timelines. The media industry has been shrinking. There's very little money out there. And so these people have to file stories enormously fast. And they really, what they do is cutting and pasting from various press releases, you know, a quote here, a quote there. And then, of course, they get a token quote from somebody who will be described as an anti-nuclear activist, right, or something of that sort. And when you are described that way, you're already being discounted by the reader. So it's heavily tailored against us. But I think there's also, interestingly, if you were to ask people in the nuclear industry, they will probably say that the media is biased against them. And they would probably say, oh, you know, the media always talks about Chernobyl or Fukushima or all of these negative stories. They don't tell the great attributes of nuclear. And this is something which we have seen in the nuclear industry for many years now. They are complaining always that their great attributes are not recognized. They would love to say how they are a clean source of power, all within quotes, of course, how they are a reliable source of power, and the media doesn't highlight all of that. I think one reason why we both sides see the media in different ways as being against their interests is that the media, I think, tries to operate within a narrow space to deal with the climate crisis, for example. They want to say that we can solve the climate problem just using some technologies here, rather than asking any larger questions about our society, about how it needs to change, about our politics, and so on and so forth. They don't want to ask any of these larger questions. So they like stories that make you feel good, that we can solve the problem without doing anything major. Change a few bulbs here, put on a solar panel on your roof, and build a few nuclear plants. And they see all of them in the same way. That, I think, is a fundamental challenge. And this has to do with also who controls the media. The media is controlled by very rich people who benefit from the current social setup. They don't want anything to be messed up here. You know, in my book, I also point out that this is part of the reason why we see billionaires like Bill Gates and Sam Altman and so on also promoting nuclear energy. They don't necessarily gain a lot of personal wealth from it, but they are really invested in making sure that nobody asks fundamental questions. So when there is, you know, Greta Thunberg or somebody like that who is asking deep changes in our society, they really do not like that. And I think the media also shares the same set of assumptions.
There's so much in your book to go over because you provide the basics and then you build upon them. One of the points you make early on is that the consequences of nuclear expansion will fall primarily on poor, marginalized, often indigenous communities. How intentional is that by the industry?
Intention is not something we can really know because we can't go inside their heads or we don't go inside their boardrooms to ask for us to hear them say that. But given that there is so much documentation about how bad uranium mining has been to indigenous communities, all of the other risks associated with this, there is no doubt that they ought to know about it. And if they are going ahead and planning their projects, you can either attribute intentionality or deliberately avoiding thinking about it and talking about it. And this, again, is typical, I think, of a lot of how we carry on activities in our society, which is try and outsource the harmful consequences onto some other population that is not going to be so powerful. Again, this is true for many other industries, like, you know, plastics, for example, or all kinds of other materials that we use. But in the case of the nuclear industry, I think they are trying to pretend to be clean. And therefore, having all of these environmental and health impacts not be seen by majority communities and, you know, being visited only on small disempowered communities, which are typically geographically far away, helps them maintain that image more easily than if it had been, for example, if we have to construct the Yucca Mountain repository, not in Yucca Mountain, but in, let's say, in the Bay Area in California, things would be very different. because the people there would be like, okay, what's happening here? What's subjecting myself and my descendants to? But when it's in Yucca Mountain, it's far away. The nuclear industry typically talks about it being a isolated or abandoned or unoccupied area, that it becomes very easy for them to minimize or to hide the impacts.
Another part of hiding the impact, which you address in the book, is the fact that people don't understand about radiation, and that the nuclear industry, using